That's Mark chapter 14, verse 27. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." "Truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted empathetically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And all the others said the same. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." He then returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. He did not know what to say to them. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The man seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There, he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even their testimony did not agree." Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the heaven clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? He asked. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophecy." And the guards took him and beat him up. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said, but he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out to the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "This fellow is one of them." Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, "Surely you're one of them, for you are a Galilean." He began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately, the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoke to him. "Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times." And he broke down and wept.
Well, good morning. It's lovely to see you. My name's Matt. If we haven't had the privilege of meeting yet, I'm the associate pastor here at the church. And actually, thanks to everyone who's been involved in our service today. Some of us might not quite realize, but it takes actually quite a lot of effort into making our service happen here each week. Our band and our setup team, we're here at 8 o'clock working hard to get things ready. Our audiovisual team over there have been working hard to make it sound as good as we can. And our hosting team has been setting things up so that they're ready to welcome you when you've come in. We had a team putting communion things together over here. Our Trinity kids leaders have been preparing through the week and are out there now teaching our kids. There's the team that's been on the coffee cart, those who've put together morning tea that we'll share together afterwards. It takes a lot to put together this time, and so we appreciate those who serve us so well. But I wonder, it's good to stop and ask, actually, why? Why do we put all that effort in each Sunday? And of course, it's not just about those serving jobs either. Our community gathers together week by week. Contribute to the richness of our community life. I wonder, why do we do that? There are other things we could be doing on Sunday mornings, right? Sleeping in, taking a nice walk on the beach, having a nice brunch somewhere. I mean, the coffee here is pretty good. But why? What is it that makes us gather together? Sundays as well. Our growth groups meet together at other times during the week, and our leaders prepare and our hosts welcome people into their homes. As Simon said before, on Thursday night we were here running Taste and See. Lots of effort went into cooking beautiful food, preparing a beautiful room, welcoming people well and presenting great content. And then on Friday night we were here with our youth group. The food wasn't quite as beautiful as at Taste and See, but crispy potato gems in the oven do have their charm as well. Again, our leaders prepare, give up their time. Why? Why do we do all these things? And of course, I've spoken about some of the formal things that we do at church. There are informal things we do, aren't there? There are people get together for meals. We enjoy coffees together. We share with each other. We pray for each other. We read the Bible with each other. We encourage and care for each other in all sorts of ways. But why? Why do we do all that stuff? What is it actually all about? Why does all the effort go into all the various things that make up our life together as a community? Well, today in the book of Mark, we have arrived at the Easter story, the Last Supper, Jesus' betrayal and arrest, Jesus brought before the authorities and brutalized. And as we come to these events that are at the very heart of Christianity, we have a precious opportunity to reflect on what it is that's at the very center, the why, the very heart of what our church is all about. Why do we gather together each week? Why do we run events and work so hard to provide opportunities for people to share the gospel? Why do we care for each other and cherish our life together as a community and as a church family? Why do we do what we do? What is it all about? Well, the answer is right here in front of us in the story we're looking at over the next couple of weeks. It's right there in front of us in this chapter that we've had read out today. The heart of everything, the center of what we believe, is right here before us. And we're going to dive into this over the next little while this morning. I hope you can see this is a valuable thing to come and see what is right at the heart of what we're on about. Like so many other things in life, all sorts of things over time can distract us. We can move away from what's at the heart of what really matters. Today we get the chance to come back, to be reminded, or perhaps to understand for the very first time what is at the very core of what we believe. And by the way, you might be visiting this morning, a newcomer, you might not have been here for too long. I think this is a great week to be here. Every week, of course, is a great week to be here, but this is a chance especially to see what is at the heart of this church, what motivates everything we do, what makes us tick. So I hope this is helpful for you too. Now, the plan today is we're going to be thinking about all these readings we've had read out this morning, the two readings, this long night and before at the Lord's Supper that started at night, and that reading with the woman who poured perfume on Jesus' feet. A long night with a number of different sections, a number of different encounters that happened during this night. We won't have time, of course, to dive into the detail of all the little bits that we had read out. But I've got three things in particular that I thought we should notice from looking at this chapter and this long night. The tests, the trial, and the gift. The tests, the trial, and the gift. We'll notice those three things. And at the end, we will come back and think for a few moments about how we might respond. But what is at the heart of our church? What's at the heart of everything we do here? Let's first notice the tests. And I call this sermon today the Night of Tests and Trials, because as I read through this chapter that we've had read out, I notice just all the different moments of testing that come from the various people in this story. And for most part, these tests don't go well. They're failed tests. This is me at university trying Maths 1A for the first time. Failure. Just notice the tests that these people go through in our chapter today. We could notice Judas. Judas was one of Jesus' 12 followers. He was one of Jesus' trusted companions. But when it came to the crunch, he faced a test of whether he would choose his loyalty to Jesus or whether he would go with his desire for cash, for money. And in the end, he chose the dollars. He goes to the Jewish leaders and offers to betray Jesus for money. And even when Jesus reveals, "I know what you're doing, Judas," you kind of think maybe Judas might reconsider, but no, Judas goes through with it. He betrays Jesus with a kiss. The lure of money ends up being just too much. And then what about the rest of the disciples? They're tested in the garden. This one has actually a lot of context, because last week we just had a whole chapter about keeping watch for Jesus. And here the disciples are told in the garden, keep watch. They have a chance to put that into practice straight away. And of course, we can sympathize a little bit with the disciples, because this is a long night that we're reading about. They've had a big Passover dinner. It's late at night. They were probably thinking they'd just go back to their rooms and go to bed, but Jesus drags them out to the garden. But in the end, they fail their test too. They don't keep watch. Twice Jesus comes back and finds them fast asleep. And at one level, we can hardly blame them, but it does seem to be that they haven't understood the priority and the urgency of the situation that they're in. At the end of the day, in this moment, they choose to put their own needs for rest and comfort above the need to follow Jesus. And then if we're looking at those who face tests in this chapter, I think we should look at the Jewish leaders. Through the book of Mark, the Jewish leaders have had chance after chance to recognize that this is God's chosen one. This is the one their very faith has been waiting for centuries. And in some ways, it's still not too late at this point. They could still recognize that this is Jesus the Messiah and choose to worship him. But here really is their ultimate moment of failure. God's Son himself is brought to them, and they don't honor God by showing compassion or integrity or respect for his Son. They disgrace themselves. They make false statements. And these elders, you know, these are religious priests, respectable people, but behind closed doors, they show their true colors. They spit on Jesus and they hit him with their fists and they get the guards to give him a beating. This is religion at its worst. Power-hungry old men desperately trying to hang on to what they have without any reverence for God or concern for how their actions affect others. They fail the test. And then finally, we come to Peter, perhaps Jesus' very best friend and most loyal follower. And earlier in the reading, you might be struck by Peter's bravado. Verse 29, even if everyone else falls away, I won't, says Peter. Verse 31, even if I have to die, I'm sticking with you, Jesus. But by the end of our passage today, three times Peter fails the test, fails to admit that he even knows Jesus. Why does he fail like that? I think it's the pressure that others are putting on, isn't it? Pressure of what others will do and say if he does admit to knowing Jesus. And the pressure is on in this story, make no mistake. As a little aside, I don't know if you picked up right in the middle of our chapter, but some people get distracted by it. Verse 51 and verse 52, there's a young man who's following Jesus and ends up having his cloak taken off, and then he runs away naked. It's very funny. People often ask just what's going on with that? Who's this young guy who runs off naked? Some people guess that actually it could be Mark himself who wrote this gospel, just sort of putting a little self-reference into the book. Might be, might not, but what these verses do actually show, I think, is it's just another little picture of the pressure of this night, that it would be better for this young guy to run away naked than to face the shame of doing a nudie run than to stay in the middle of this intense situation. And the intensity is too much for Peter as well. He decides it's easier to give up his loyalty to Jesus, and he fails the test. Now, one way we could think about this chapter that we're looking at together is we could look at these tests and we could think, well, how would I go with these tests? Judas chose the money. Would I make that choice? The disciples prioritized their own rest and comfort. Is that my problem? Is that the test that I fail? The Jewish leaders, I think they care too much about their own power. Would I choose my own power over following Jesus? Would I pass that test? And Peter perhaps chooses safety. He'd rather stay on the good side of people than declare his loyalty to Jesus. Is that something I would struggle with? And all those issues might be good things to think about. But as I said today, I think today is a chance for us to think about what's at the very heart of Christian faith, the very heart of what we believe. And I think if we jumped into all those sorts of topics, I think we'd actually miss the really big point that's right in the heart of what we've read today. So far we've noticed the tests, but let's move to our second point and let's notice the trial. Jesus is put on trial in our passage today. He's brought before the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin. The evidence is presented. He still hasn't gone to the trial that he's going to have before the Roman authorities. That's going to wait till the next morning once the sun comes up. We're going to look at that next week. But let's start by saying this. If anyone we've looked at in our story so far other than Jesus was put on trial, a trial would find that they have failed, wouldn't it? They would come out on the losing side. Judas, you chose the money. The disciples, you couldn't keep watch. The Jewish leaders, you're a disgrace to your roles and you show no integrity before God. Peter, well, you didn't have what it took to stay loyal when the pressure came. And I think today's passage might ask us as well, if we were put on trial, what would the outcome be? If it's true that God made this world and made us, and if it's true that all good things come from Him, if every breath we breathe is a gift from God, if every meal we eat is a gift from God, if every good laugh we have with friends comes from Him, if it's true that He's given us all those good things, well, have we given Him thanks? Have we stayed loyal to Him and followed Him as we should? Have we always done that? Or have there been times when we've failed those tests and cared more about our own comfort or our cash or our power or our standing before others? I certainly know that I've failed to live for Jesus and live His way and still fail to live His way and live for Him lots of the time. And I think actually, even if we took Jesus completely out of the picture, and some of us might say, well, I don't actually think I really owe God or Jesus anything. I don't really think I owe Him any loyalty, especially if we're not really convinced that Jesus was who He said He was. I think, though, even if you take that picture away, I think if we put ourselves on trial, I think if most of us, if we're honest, would probably admit that we don't even live up to our own standards. Me and my wife went to see Taylor Swift a couple of weeks ago. What does she sing? It's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me. I can stare directly at the sun, but never in the mirror. We don't live the way we want. When we look in the mirror, we're not who we want to be, at least not completely. But now here's the thing, and I think this is where I really want you to hear me well, because this is where we could get the passage wrong. We could look at the tests we fail and feel like we're going to be found guilty in a trial. But in this story that we've read, in the Easter story, who is on trial? Was it the disciples? No. Was it the Jewish leaders? No. Is it us on trial? No. It's not what the passage is about. This passage is about Jesus. Jesus is the one on trial. And how does it look when we come to the trial of Jesus? Well, just notice through the story, his composure. He's distressed in the garden about what he was going through on this long night, no doubt. But in the middle of the tension and the panic and the desire for other things, he's calm and he's composed and he knows what he needs to prioritize. When others draw swords, he says, "Am I leading a rebellion? You could have come and got me any time." And he goes willingly with the authorities. And notice his control. He's completely in control the whole time. He knows who's going to betray him. He says, "Judas, it's the one who dipped the bread in the bowl at the same time as me." He knows exactly who it is. He knows the rooster's going to crow two times before Peter betrays him. He knows what's going to happen, and he knows that his father's will is what will be done. And then notice his integrity. Faced with great injustice, he does nothing wrong. He doesn't try and weasel out of it. He doesn't try and tell stories to get away with it. He speaks honestly. He's honest about who he is. We have Judas who chose the money, but Jesus doesn't just give up the money. He gives up his whole life. And the disciples, well, they chose comfort. Jesus chose to go to death rather than comfort. The Jewish leaders, well, they were a disgrace to their roles and they showed no integrity. Well, Jesus' integrity is perfect. And Peter cracks under the pressure, but Jesus is calm and in control. Jesus passes every test the disciples failed. He passes every test we'd fail. He's innocent. In fact, more than that, he's perfect. And yet he's the one arrested. He's the one beaten. He's the one found guilty, worthy of death. And so this then takes us to our third point, and what is at the very heart of what our church is all about? The test, the trial, the gift. I wonder, why do you think Jesus went so willingly to his death? He was innocent, but he willingly went to receive this punishment. Well, the answer to that question is given unto us in the picture of the Lord's Supper. And the Lord's Supper is given to us actually not just as a picture that you could see on a wall, but given to us as something we can taste and touch and smell and savour. The bread, it's a reminder of the gift of his body broken for us. The wine, it's a gift. It's given to us, he says. He gave it to them. And they drank it. "This is my blood," Jesus says, "poured out for many." In that Passover meal, Jesus told the disciples exactly why he would die. His body was being broken for them. His blood was going to be shed for them and for the many, for us as well. And it's no coincidence that this all happens at Passover time. For those who don't know, Passover was that Jewish celebration. It went back many centuries before Jesus. Jews still celebrate it now, of course, back to the time of the book of Exodus is where it began. We went through that part of the book of Exodus last year together as a church. We're coming back to do the second half of the book of Exodus in a couple of months, actually. The Passover was a celebration of the night where God had freed his people from slavery in Egypt. In Egypt, on Passover night, the firstborn in every house had been killed, except for his people. God had told them to take a lamb, to kill and eat the lamb, roast it on an open flame like we do on our barbecues. Take the blood of the lamb and paint the blood on your door frames. And for those houses where God saw that the lamb's blood had been shed, he passed over. The firstborn was spared. Blood had already been shed. There was no more debt to pay. And the Jews had celebrated the Passover ever since. It had become the high point of their religious calendar year. I don't think it would be wrong to compare Passover to something a little bit like Christmas, a big celebratory meal with all the family together. Lots of the traditions in the Passover were deliberately set up to include children and young ones so that the story of the Passover could be continued on to the next generation. It's partly why when we take the Lord's Supper here each Sunday, we try and include the whole church family, including the young ones. And the Jews at the Passover meal, well, they had actually a whole lot of traditions. One was around cups. They had four cups, actually, and each cup reminded them of part of God's covenant, of his promises that he'd made to them in Exodus. The first cup reminded them of God's promise to bring them out of Egypt. And they had a second cup, which reminded them of God's promise of rescue. And the third cup reminded them of God's promise to redeem them. And the fourth cup reminded them of God's promise to take them as his own people. You can go back and read all four of those promises in Exodus chapter 6. But on this Passover night, after hundreds of years of the Jews taking those four cups together, Jesus took another cup. He took a new cup. And he said, this cup is the blood of the new covenant, a new promise that his blood would be shed for the many. On Passover night, the Jews had needed one lamb for each household, the blood of one lamb given in exchange for one firstborn, one life for one life. But Jesus' blood was given in exchange for the lives of the many. And he went to trial and he was found guilty, put to death. But in exchange, whoever seeks the safety of his blood can have life. We can go free. This is the gift that Jesus gives. This is the heart of what we're on about here at Trinity Church Brighton. This is why we do what we do. Because we love Jesus and we're thankful for this gift. And this gift of salvation comes to us as a free gift. We say it comes because of his grace. We don't earn it by what we do. We trust in Jesus and this gift is ours. A free gift that comes to us. Of course, that's different from saying it's a cheap gift. A couple of months ago, there was a new toy store that opened up on Marion Road. Some of the families might have gone and visited it. For some reason, we thought that we would take the kids over there for opening day. Hundreds of kids going nuts inside a toy store. Don't know what we were thinking, but for the opening of the toy store, every kid who came along got a free gift. I think one of the girls got a little headbandy thing that broke in about 5 seconds. One of the girls got a little cheap sticker that didn't even really work properly. They were free gifts. We got something for free, but they were cheap gifts. With Jesus, his gift of forgiveness, freedom, salvation, it's a free gift, but it's not a cheap gift. It's the most precious gift anyone's ever given. I think that's partly behind the story of the woman who poured the expensive jar of perfume on Jesus' feet at the start of our chapter. It said that in that that perfume was worth more than a year's wages. Could you imagine taking a bottle of perfume worth maybe six figures and you imagine that bottle being poured off over someone's feet? But Jesus says she's done a beautiful thing. Maybe it's because she understands just a little bit of the preciousness of the gift that Jesus is about to give his people. A preciousness that could never be matched. The gift of his very body and his blood poured out. He passed every test and yet he was found guilty and punished accordingly. We know we don't pass every test. We know if we were on trial, we'd be on the losing side. But because his blood has been shed, our punishment has been paid. We can stand before God free and forgiven as his beloved children. That means we can belong to him. We can join his family, join his people, and we can look forward to the future hope that is promised for his people. And we might not be able to look in the mirror and see ourselves as innocent or perfect, but if we trust in Jesus, we should look in the mirror and know that we're loved by God, forgiven by God, accepted by God, and included by God because of this gift that Jesus has given us. Well then, let me finish with a couple of quick thoughts about what we might take away from this. One thing it's good to remember, the heart of everything we're on about, isn't it? We do lots of things here at church. We serve each other, care for each other, participate in all sorts of ways. Lots of times being involved is fun, and we might say it's its own reward because we have a great time doing it. But let's remember what's really at the heart. Why do we serve? Why do we really do it? What's motivating us deep down? Well, we're not about just running a church so we can have a great local community organization that puts on great events. We don't have a church because we think we're a great worthy people and you should come and be part of our exclusive club because we're pretty good and if you're good, you should come and be part of us too. At the core of what we're on about, at the heart, is that we believe what we've read today. We believe that we couldn't stand before God on our own. We couldn't stand before a trial and be found innocent based on what we've done. But we believe Jesus did go to a trial and that he went in our place and that his body and blood were given for us. When we take the Lord's Supper, as we did this morning, as we do each month here at church, it really is a special reminder of what's right at the heart of what we believe. We believe that he's given us a free and very precious gift, and that because of his grace, we can be part of God's eternal kingdom. That's what we're about. We believe this promise We love Jesus and we want to serve him in response. And so if this is what we believe, we should serve if we're able. We should be excited about being involved in what God's on about. We should be excited about others hearing about this gift. Be excited about people growing to trust in Jesus more and more. Everything we're on about as a church should really go back to this. And so as we do serve and as we do care for each other and as we speak about Jesus, let's remember what's at the core. Let's let this free gift of grace be our core motivation. And let's let it shape us. Grace shapes us in all sorts of ways, of course. And if we believe what we've heard today, that we're saved because of a gift, not because of our own awesomeness, well, it should encourage us to approach life with great humility. We should have great humility as we serve, great humility as we make decisions, or even great humility just in the way we interact with others daily, the way we speak to others, the way we parent, the way we go about managing our households. But before we finish then, a second response as we think about what we've looked at today. We've said, okay, what's at the core? That's good to be reminded of. But I also want to encourage us today to believe what we've heard. Some of us here today might actually not be so sure about Jesus. That might be because we're not convinced that what we've read is true. It might be because we're not sure Jesus really has something good in store for us. We're going to keep thinking about those questions as we come to Easter and as we go into our Good and True series after Easter. Looking forward to keep thinking about those things. But I do want to encourage you now, the gift that we've talked about today is available to you. His death happened. His blood was shed for the many. These things are true. And we can come, trust in him and take shelter in him, believe in him. I wonder if today might be a day for you to take that step. But also some of us, we might have trusted in Jesus for a long time, but we still might be finding it hard to believe some of what we've heard today. We might be finding it hard thinking that we seem to keep failing these tests again and again, maybe keep failing the same test again and again. I know that feeling. We might be finding it hard to believe that the gift of Jesus' blood is really enough. Finding it hard to look in the mirror because we can't keep believing that he could keep looking at us and keep forgiving us time and time again. And the message I think we can take from today is that yes, our sins are great. Yes, we do fail sometimes, maybe a lot of the time. But the message we need to hear today is that we're not on trial. Jesus was the one on trial. And the blood that he shed was, when he was put to death, was enough. Whatever you've done, whoever you've been, whatever you will do, his blood is enough. And by the way, nothing else could ever be enough. The other side of this is that we might have subtly over the years, even if we've known it once, we might have started to forget that this is at the heart of what we believe. We might have drifted a little bit, started to maybe think of our faith as sort of trusting that I'm the person that I've made myself to be, trusting in how I've lived, perhaps trusting in the role that we have, or trusting in the knowledge that we've built, or trusting in the impacts that I've made in the things I've been involved with. Remember what's at the heart. It's not about what we've done or what we could do. It's about him. If all of what we've read today is true, and if Jesus really was who he said he was, well, then there also is someone called Satan. Jesus spoke about Satan. Satan would love us to think either that we're enough for Jesus on our own, so we don't need him, or he'd love us to think that he's not enough for us, that our sins are too great, and so we won't go to him. Don't be fooled. Let's trust today in Jesus' words. Jesus has given us a promise, a covenant, a new promise, brought down to us generation by generation in his word and shown to us every time we take the Lord's Supper together. And Jesus promises this. He says it this way in the book of John. Very truly I tell you, whoever hears my words and believes him who sent me has eternal life and will not be judged, but has crossed over from death to life. Though we fail the tests, though we know if we're on trial, we'd come out on the losing side. We can know as well, if we trust in Jesus' gift, we will not be judged. We've already passed from death to life. And so today we can say, thank you, Father, for the grace of Jesus. Amen. We're going to take a moment to reflect on our own. Two questions are on the screen that you might find helpful. What's at the heart of my faith at the moment? And how might I serve Jesus in response to his grace?